This session is from the 2021 Shepherd's 360 International Church Leaders Conference. For more information, visit shepherds360.org.
Well, why don't we get started? It's 4:12. This is the workshop called Multisite Mania. I didn't name it. They did here. I just gave them the topic I wanted to deal with. But it's pretty sensationalistic. I guess we like it now. We're going to assess the pros and cons of the multi-site church model. Here's the goal for me with you. This conversation comes up often, and in our world today, with technology and even especially post-COVID, I think a lot of us have a deeper appreciation for online resourcing and for being a little flexible. All of us come from different contexts and different states even. I'm in Arizona where you guys know everyone had a different context during this whole thing, and even now where we didn't necessarily have to tell our people to come to church and to we're going to gather or anything like that. We had to calm them down because we're in the wild, wild west, and I've got guys that in our congregation, preaching to them, it was like, hey, let's not be on our driveway with an AR going, come get some, come take it. We didn't struggle with that in Arizona at all. So we were preaching through 1 Peter, and I said, honor the emperor. The Bible says it. I didn't make it up. And we went to apply that, and, Nero, probably worse than Biden, obviously, but, a guy let out a gasp in the middle of the service. Was like, oh, and he was upset. That's Arizona. And so the point of that illustration is different contexts. Open carry in Costco, go. And 9 mil on your head. That is normal. I've preached carrying in Arizona. Some of you come from contexts where it was way different, where your people were hiding and they were scared of everything. And not that there weren't serious things to consider and there were concerns and there was political turmoil and there were challenges. We need to be really fair. I mean, you guys just had an elder pass away, right, from COVID complications. And we had it twice in our family. So we want to be careful with all the extremes. Same with topics like this, where we want to give respect and understanding. Around the world, there's different formats, and you have places in which there is only a few qualified elders on the mission field, and yet there's many people being converted and getting saved. And so what do you do on a Sunday? What do you do randomly? Are you allowed to have church on a Thursday? Can you go to some village on a Tuesday? It can get pretty intense and extra biblical. So we want to use a lot of care, nuance, and maturity when thinking through this. And at the same time, in our context, think through the cautions and the care that we have to make sure we're aware of so that we don't hamstring discipleship, multiplication, and then in any context, whether known or unknown, whether rural or, metropolitan areas, if we experience a lot of growth, numerical growth, the temptation is always there. It has been there since Old Testament times. It's there now in the church age. When things grow, often the ego grows and we can start to dabble in those narcissistic tendencies. And we can also start to think, well, this is spiritual. I mean, I'm just the reason that things are going good and God's using me. And so I'm this and I'm that. And all of a sudden the personal pronouns start coming out, and people on our teams and staff and elders, they love the growth. They love that the Lord is blessing the work numerically, financially. You could have baptisms, conversions, so many different things happening. And then at the same time, no one wants that to stop. So what do we need to do to keep it going? And a lot of multi-site enthusiasts will say, hitch your wagon to that guy. Hitch your wagon to your dynamic, charismatic, somebody, and he'll get you there and he'll keep you there. Because who wants to lose? Who wants to lose millions of dollars coming in? Who wants to lose hundreds of thousands of dollars? Who wants to lose all the full seats when revival is happening and we're going, look at this. This is what we planted for. This is what we wanted to see. This is what we've been praying for. Nobody wants to stop it. And so we do need to have mature, clear, reasonable thinking so that we don't become our own worst enemy in the midst of growth. I want to start this session two ways. First, pull your Bible out if you have it. I know workshops aren't always expository, so you may have just come with a phone. But go to 1 Peter 5:1-4 and just keep your finger there. We're going to walk through that. And then I want to show you a quick video clip that will help you understand the context of what we're talking about and some of the thinking that can go into the multi-site conversation. We'll watch about 90 seconds of this and then skip to the end and jump in.
So, hey, Mark, how many sites at your church?
10, hoping to open 11 this summer.
Great, and how many services?
24-ish.
Yeah, we got 5 sites going to 6. We have 13 going to 15 weekend services. You know, more than 10,000 people in both of our churches, hundreds and hundreds of decisions for Christ every year, praise God, baptized. And here is our brother, mentor, theological genius. When his book on church polity came out, I was like, are you kidding me? I couldn't I couldn't even carry it, let alone read it. It's so full. You're like smarter than I'll ever be. So, but you don't have multi-site.
Oh, my goodness.
You don't even have multi-services.
Oh, what's going
on? But you certainly could fill more if you had them with your amazing gift of preaching. And I know people are coming to Christ in your church. You're planting churches. So you've obviously decided differently than we've decided. Yeah. We'll tell you why we're right in a minute. But you tell us why you're doing it the way you are.
All right. The word ecclesia in the New Testament means assembly.
According to
the Bible. I mean,
Acts 18, when there's the riot in Ephesus,
according
they have an assembly.
But even
according
if,
the usage,
even if it means assembly,
yeah. Even if it means assembly, it doesn't mean one and only assemble, all assemble together.
And not the whole church is present at that time. Anyway.
Do you have children's ministry?
It does mean that. Yeah.
Okay, so they're assembled in a different place. You've already broken that code.
Yeah.
Just break it again.
Yeah. I think that we have an assembly, and what we want to do with more assemblies is have more elders and more preachers.
So you kind of get the point pretty quick. It ends this way.
It's 80 or less.
Yeah, right.
So
his is an anomaly.
They're giving us the 10 minutes, so right. I guess we're going to be done. But before, since he's Baptist, and it is appropriate, I think we should take a vote on whether or not multi-site
is
biblical.
I'd like to make a motion that all churches commit to multi-site and to church planting as a collective strategy for getting out the good news of Jesus Christ. Do I have a seconder?
I second the motion.
So that means I must be cheering. I rule the motion out of order.
2-1. We love you, Mark.
We love you.
And when you go multi-site, we will show up and celebrate your first Sunday.
Yes, Lord, I will.
Yes.
So you get the point. The way that a generation has approached multi-site is not as nuanced as we want to be fair to. Not necessarily as flexible as I think we would need to be on the mission field and in different places. But what I'm referring to when we go through this material is the examples like that, where in the modern American church, we have decided that this anointed leader, this very gifted, very dynamic, very strong personality is the way we're going to grow, the way that the money's going to come in, the one that God's anointed. And we can do some other things, but ultimately, this is the person that we need to put front and center. At those multi-site locations, what you have typically is going to be a big screen, and that individual is there because they are the reason, by definition, in these circles that everyone is coming. Anyway, I'll give you one quick story. I've been in a meeting with Driscoll over the last couple of years because I'm in the Phoenix area, and pastors will sometimes get together and talk about different things. So I got invited to be a silent observer, which I did a good job, and I stayed silent, of a meeting. And I remember at the meeting, two things were prevalent. Number one, the narrative on church planting had changed. Church planting was a dumb idea. That was the clear sentiment. And number two, multi-site was the way to go. And the reason for that is his belief and the worldview on this in their version of ecclesiology is that God has anointed a man and his ministry and his preaching and his speaking. And without him, it can't grow. Without him, people will not come. And he is the reason. He is the anointed. And God is still, just like Old Testament or a New Testament Paul, divvying out this apostolic anointing in which there is a single man who is the face, he is the reason, and he is the pull or the gravitas for the ministry. And we ought to accept it. And I remember being deeply concerned in that meeting, talked about it with our team on the way back. And I've seen some of this in different circles as well. The church growth movement is another big one, which is more of that pragmatic circle attached to the Driscollian philosophy, if you want to call it that, where, you know, church planting is there because we know we have to. It's like when your kids give you the right Bible answer, but they're still rebellious when, you know, yeah, I know, I love God, or they go to church. We do the same thing sometimes. People in our churches do this as adults. We do all the right things because we know we have to in order to almost throw meat in the corner if there's a lion in the room, so to speak. So it goes after the meat, not you. Church planting is used in a lot of these circles as a way to appease the desire for multiplication and to appease the biblical forward motion of the church. Because you'll have elders, you'll have people, when you teach them the Bible, say, shouldn't we be planting churches? Shouldn't we be raising up elders? Shouldn't we be doing these things? And of course, we need to say, well, yeah, and we are. But the bigger vision and where we are now culturally is the multi-site model. Why I had to turn to 1 Peter chapter 5 is because that text gives us a beautiful picture of what the exhortation to church leaders is in the New Testament. Therefore, Peter says, I exhort the elders among you, as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God among you. Obviously, that doesn't need a terrible amount of exposition. It's pretty clear. There's going to be an assignment of people among you where you are, exercising oversight, not under compulsion. Look at some of these qualifying statements. But voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain. I'm reading out of the NASB. I know some of your translations will have other phrases that describe the same thing. But with eagerness. There's this driving forward and a desire to shepherd those people under your care. Not yet as lording, or nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge. So there's another almost ownership, stewardship phrase that he uses, but proving to be examples to the flock. That's the phrase that I want to zero in on. When he uses the word example, he's literally saying a type, a model, a statue. That's what the original word means. In other words, not in a glorifying way, not in a, hey, look at me on a screen way, but in a life-on-life way. The way that you and I would want to be with someone if they said, can I see the way that you do this? Or how do you love your wife? Or how do you keep your family ministry first? How do you win at home? Can you show me something, or can you give me wisdom? And we see life on life as the model in the New Testament. Now, things grow, and you have in the Acts account 3,000 souls added in. So this isn't a case against numerical growth. It is a case for stewardship of the people that God has given us. And when things grow, God is not in the business of providing you massive numbers, giving you thousands of souls, and not within those souls also gifting the church its elders. He does that, and he's done that for millennia in the church. So it's not about me. It's not about you. It's not about the one. We might be, in a sense, when you church plant, a tip of the spear where you get the ball rolling for people. Or if you're here and you're a pastor teacher, a teaching pastor, a lead pastor, they might call you. And even in models of plurality, the elders in the room may look at you and say, we're charging you, brother, since you're gifted at preaching and teaching, to be the mouthpiece for us when the church gathers. We're also charging you with the responsibility to be a trigger man in this room and to talk about where we're heading and to be a gatekeeper of doctrine and to pour in to the other leaders, because we need men doing that. At the same time, everybody understands that it is never about one person or one man. And when we die, there should be ministry continuing on. The test of great leadership, as so many of you guys know, is not when you're there, but when you're not there, when you're gone. I got a video I was telling some of you guys earlier when I'm here, and it's a testament not to my great leadership. It's a testament to God's gift of my wife to me and the care right now in my home. And I got a video earlier, and she's sitting at the table and catechizing our kids and my one son, you know, how did God made you? And he's like, from dirt. He means from dust. And she's walking with the kids. I'm able to even start this workshop with total peace of mind, thinking my wife right now, in the middle of chaos with four kids, seven and under, is at home holding down the fort. Why? Because she is, in her own right, in her own role, a great leader. She's in our home doing a great job. Obviously, we believe in complementarianism and male headship, and I'm the, quote, leader of the home. But how you establish something in the right ways will carry it beyond just you. Same thing in the church, where when we're not there, or one day you grow old and die, things carry on. So moving into my arguments, before we do that, I want to make sure that I'm clear about a few helpful realities. First, we might ask the question, has online media gone too far? Or is online media helpful? Where does online media fit into the paradigm that we're discussing? I'm sure you all have thought about this as well, and so I want to deal with that a little bit. We live in an era in which media is a huge part of our life. Here's some statistics for you. Social media use in particular around the world. We've got now 4.48 billion active users on social media. That's pretty much, well, a lot of young kids in the world today. You could say almost the entire planet, because babies and different people that are disabled or not necessarily using social media would be counted in the total number of human population. And so that's a massive number of active populace on planet Earth. Social media users as a percentage of the global population. Again, this is the entire world. So all people, all ages, 56.8% of the entire world on social media. Annual change in the number of global social media users. Look at this number, 520 million more people every year. So by the time, Lord willing, we see each other next year at Shepherd's 360 again, we'll have added another 520 million people into the online world. Percentage of social media users accessing via their mobile phones. This is wild, 99%. 99% of people on social media are doing it through their cell phone, which means there is a constant access point. I've got mine on the podium right now. Texting my wife just before the session, checking the time on what? My phone. I've got a watch on my wrist, there's a clock on the wall, and I still kept looking at my phone. Why? Because we get attached to the thing. I've got notifications about where we're eating dinner tonight. I got the nice driver who brought us over here and was helping some of the speakers let me know that he brought a Starbucks over for me because he happened to be going there, and he asked if I want any sweetener in it. You got conference organizers letting you know what room. It's constant. People tagging you, people writing you, people emailing you. It's on and on and on through the phone. Average amount of time per day spent using social media. Obviously, for some people, this number is going to be way bigger. But the average, 2 hours and 24 minutes, 2.5 hours. The average church service is 60 to 70 minutes. Yep. If you put a little time into the Lord's table, you go 75, and then people give you the evil eye because you're going in their lunch plans. But overall, we're on social media way more. You weigh that against, you know, screen time versus prayer time, you realize we are bombarded with media all day. But we're also bombarded with food, supplies, the need for groceries, activities, recreation. Are all those things evil? Is social media evil? Is everything taking up our time evil? Or are there qualities and things that we can redeem out of it, or things that we can use it for? The simple answer is obviously yes. Technology is not evil and sinful in and of itself. We can use it to spread the gospel. This last year, we launched For the Gospel, our media resourcing ministry, for this exact purpose. We even are on TikTok. I don't do any of the videos or do any dances or anything like that, but we put our ministry on TikTok, and we do these short, quick videos that are clear, that are gospel-focused and Christ-centered, because there's some 500 million users on TikTok. The number grows literally daily, and that's a mission field. I'm not going to leave TikTok as a wasteland just to do nothing with it. We thought as a ministry, well, why not stick something there? And sure enough, one of our videos went viral because a woman dared to say that her husband was the head of the home, and the feminists came roaring. But also some Bible folk came roaring, and followership increased, and awareness and breadth of reach increased, and all that is good and well. That's not the point. We're not trying to go viral, but truth is helpful. We got some messages from other people that asked, do you have more resources on this? We sent them to our YouTube channel. We had a family series and on and on and go. What's the purpose? To go viral? To be an influencer? To be cool? To do this? No. To get God's people, God's resources, or God's truth wherever they are, and to introduce an entire new generation that is constantly using technology and media to engage with truth because they're on it anyway. We're going into a mission field. But just like any mission field, you don't necessarily need to establish it as a, quote, church. There's a lot of care that needs to be taken with, quote, online church or virtual pastors. Whenever people say, oh, I don't have a church right now, you're my pastor, I quickly write them back on social media and say, if you've got to drive an hour or two, I'm telling you, I'm not your pastor. I love you in the Lord. I'm so thankful for you. But watching me on Sundays online is not going to do anything for you. Watch a sermon on Tuesday. Watch it on Wednesday. Hang around your dinner table or have your movie night and watch a YouTube show. I do the same thing. I'll watch a Paul Washer sermon sometimes when I want to be convicted that maybe I'm not even saved yet. You know that? Give me some Paul Washer in my life. But he's not my pastor. The podcast pastor is not my pastor. These are helpful resources. We live in a beautiful day and age in which we can access resources and truth. We should be learning like crazy because we are redeeming our commute with podcasts. Some of our evenings with not Netflix binging, but some great resource material that can grow and strengthen us so we can win at home or pour into other people if we've already raised our children. But you know what I'm referring to when I say that. So we want to be very careful and take care. A lot of these methods can quickly become a reproach on biblical ecclesiology, which is the doctrine of the church. And what I want to take great care in is hindering future generations from entering church leadership and hindering future generations from entering the life of the church because they don't need to. Costi's doing it. Les is doing it. Mike's doing it. Joe's doing it. I'm not anointed like him. I'm not as good. I can never be him. I mean, he's the guy. Until he dies, he's the man. That will deter so many young people, or it will send them somewhere else. God's still going to raise them up and use them. We miss out on the opportunity to steward their life, their mind, their heart, and then watch joyfully as we get to deploy them into ministry. Some people will argue, I'm just using technology to do what they did in the New Testament. But the New Testament methods that are used for teaching, sharpening, exhorting, encouraging, and checking in on the church are still done primarily in person. And yet, Paul used letters. He used delegates. He definitely checked in on the church. But when he established the church at Ephesus, what did he do for 3 years? He's there in person. When he tells Titus what he's to do on Crete, he says, I left you there to appoint elders. There are supposed to be real, physical shepherd, elders, leaders in the lives of the people. He does that in person, delegates it in person. Acts 14 is a helpful chapter to read through. Verse 21, you have Barnabas and Paul appointing elders. You have Antioch involved there as well. Acts 20, verse 28, another very physical moment in which Paul, who's not always present, calls the elders, remember, down from Ephesus. They come and meet him, and there's a lot of weeping and crying. They hug his neck. They're holding on to him, and he tells them, keep watch over the flock whom the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Careful, wolves are going to come from the inside. Titus 1:5, I already mentioned it in passing. Crete and Titus, he's there to appoint elders. And then 2 Timothy 2:2, entrust these truths to faithful men who in turn will what? Teach also. They'll do the exact same thing. There's supposed to be a duplication happening because of life-on-life ministry. On and on, the pastoral epistles charge elders and church leaders to appoint other elders, to be careful in laying hands on anyone suddenly, to raise up qualified leaders. There is zero inference even about targeting just the influencers. Consumeristic methods, what will they really like in Rome? Let's do that. What's going to really get them going on Crete? Titus, this is the way the culture is, so let's do that. Not at all. Some have rightly said Paul uses aspects of philosophy and various illustrations in his preaching. Great, there's nothing wrong with using modern context in your delivery through illustration and through relating to where we are. We live in 2021. You can relate to people in 2021, but that doesn't mean those things need to overreach into our methods where we start doing things outside of biblical bounds. In the church, in the New Testament, we see in person, we see on site, we see local elders, they're in the life of the sheep, they're like ground floor troops, they are shepherd leaders. They teach, disciple, train, pray, lead, love, discipline, and care for the souls of their flocks. I already showed you the video, two recent examples, both of those men who were teasing Mark Dever have ended up disgraced in ministry. The multi-site method was not their downfall. It was simply the outworking of what can happen when we quickly become obsessed with growth, the numbers, and who we are, and all that we're doing. There can be an air of arrogance, and when we start to decide we're going to do our thing our way, because then we've immediately begun to walk down a slippery slope. So why then do people opt for the multi-site model? I can't presume on every motive. All I can do is try to walk us through some logic, but also deal with the potential threat. So why do some people opt for the multi-site church? It often comes up as an excellent way to keep momentum going. It often is the way that they deal with spatial limitations. You have a rapidly growing church. There's other different situations in which they want to grow the church as a franchise. They see themselves having influence and think, hey, we should do this everywhere. Like, this is going really well in Phoenix. Why not Minnesota? Let's go 50 states wide. And we are, in a sense, when we're in church leadership, entrepreneurial by nature when you're a leader, because you're always thinking, what? What's the next ground we need to take? What's the next community we should reach? Hey, we're doing that big event to share the gospel. Should we hit the neighborhood next door with some mailers? Hey, should we do an email blast? We're always thinking forward. How do I get more people to hear the message that I know will save their souls? So perhaps with the best of intentions, we think we're doing it the right way. You know, Shepherd's Church, this is how it should be everywhere. Imagine if these were all over the world and all over the United States. So it needs to be our brand and our way, and we need to make it this way because this is the only way or the right way. Some people think church is a business, and so they spin off sites as franchises for the purpose of building the brand or their own empire. And so typically the multi-site model is going to involve low overhead, acquiring a space, putting up a screen, filling it with chairs, and having it streamed in. So if I were preaching right now here, I'd say we're here together, but we're also hello to all of our locations. And they're all there to hear me. And then you're going to be the guy up front, and you're going to give announcements, and you're going to welcome the people. They may even have small groups, but preaching and leadership and clarity of vision is all coming from me on a screen. They'll have other programs tailored to modern American preferences. There is one main thing, though, that you often, if ever, will find, not find, rather, at the multi-site model. It will be a physical preacher who spends intentional time with his flock and with the future leaders of the church. You will not find often a plurality of elders who shepherd the flock together on a weekly basis. There may be exceptions to this. I'm sure there are. I can't say infallibly that it's always this way. That would be dangerous as well. But that is typically the standard model, because it is important that this one individual be the face of everything. Interesting enough, too, that the multi-site model tends to get under the skin of people from different denominations and even different theological backgrounds. There is widespread agreement by potentially a Pentecostal, a Baptist, a Lutheran, and then a non-denominational guy, because together they still see the important need for physical shepherding and physical leadership, whatever their theological differences. But we do have a generation of people that are used to viewing life on a screen. So conversely, there's a whole other group of people that aren't bothered by it at all. I believe with conviction that our job is not necessarily to say, well, the multi-site model is sinful and they're all just going to hell, or those are false churches. I think we need to engage an entire new generation with clarity and help them define what is church? What is ecclesiology? What is church leader? Where should I be? Who keeps watch over my soul? We tell people, you know, church leaders have authority and that they need to be submissive. Hebrews 13:17 says, to submit to those who are over you in the Lord, for they keep watch over your soul. But then what does it say? As one, let them do this without grieving, as ones who will give an account. So church members are told submit. Church leaders are going to answer Jesus for the way they enacted their leadership and their authority. We need to teach an entire generation what in the world they're supposed to submit to. They have grown up with life on a screen, and very easily they can just go through the motions and not realize that deficiencies in their life or in their discipleship or in their spiritual growth are linked to a lack of shepherding care in their personal life. But are there helpful things with the multi-site model, dare I say? Yes. Some potentially helpful aspects: providing access to church teaching where there is no church yet. Maybe there's a region or an area that has no church. It still happens on planet Earth. It may even be happening at times in various regions in our own country. Providing access to church resources and people with the goal of planting there. I've seen this done before where they begin to gather and they're watching a particular ministry or whatnot, and they're watching different things, and they say, hey, we would love to have a church. We heard you guys are church planting. Would you plant a church over here? We have been watching different sermons and checking out your ministry. And then that church in particular has some younger men or older men, whatever, who are excited to go, and then they're sent and parachuted in. And so you could have some aspects of, you know, mixture there. Temporary alleviation of overcrowding at a particular location. It's not really multi-site in the definition that we're looking at. What I'm saying is, if you have an overflow room, it's okay. You don't have to feel like you're sinning or, well, what do we do now? You know, Costi said, no, I didn't. You can put people in the family center because they are overflowing out the gate in your main sanctuary. That happens all the time. We're on location. We're together. We're there. You're not at some location somewhere else and it's, hey, keep giving and we'll see in a little bit. I'm on the screen. It may be helpful in places where the church is enabled to work around restrictive government policies. You know, there could be a day in which you are underground somewhere and your, quote, Paul or your Barnabas or your Titus or your Timothy is getting on their phone and they're whispering, turn in your Bible to Romans chapter 3. You know, they're whispering to you. I know we think that's kind of crazy in our country, but I think we've seen over the last year, maybe not in different places. And so we're not saying, of course, that you can't do what you need to do and that the Lord doesn't have some aspect of understanding ecclesiologically when you have to use different means. It could provide teaching and training, perhaps, until enough qualified leaders are raised up to lead it. A complicated situation. I just got an email a couple of weeks ago from a family in Norway. What do you do? They're in Norway. They're in the middle of nowhere. I've looked at the region. There are no real churches around them. And they came out of the New Apostolic Reformation. There's one kind of major church in their town, and it is a crazy church. It's not a biblical church.
Is it Oslo?
And
are they in Oslo, Norway?
I don't know. They're a little further out.
Okay.
Yeah, and so they're there, and they asked, they said, are we in sin? We've been watching online. We're considering moving out there for a few years. And the gentleman said, even I'm willing to get trained and figure out a way to come back as a pastor or a local elder.
Yes.
But the goal is what? A real church. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to tell our people, hey, we've got a new site in Norway. No, we don't. You've got a guy watching online because he's got no options, reading his Bible, leading his family, who very likely could be a man of character and a qualified elder, who needs support and training and then wants to go back to Norway and start a house church to get something going and evangelize the other people that they just left fellowship with. That is not at all what we're talking about, of course. And then the last element of multi-site or multi-campus, I think is the right way to say this, is you would see a church with several preaching elders throughout a city or a region going and preaching on Sundays. But what are they doing? Well, they're leading together as a plural group in different places, and those areas have elder oversight, and you have real pastors, real elders together in a community, and it's just grown larger. But there's no one guy that is the tip of the spear, the only tip. So what is the big deal? And if it's not sinful, then why in the world do a workshop about it? Or why go through various doctrinal essentials like I have about ecclesiology? Because just because something isn't sinful doesn't mean that it is unimportant. It doesn't mean it can't lead us into dangerous places, mainly because the most popular multi-site model use, which we've covered already and talked a little bit about, can slaughter our discipleship. It can undermine the way that we're serving the church, and it can hamstring our gospel efforts. So I think we need to get over The fear that we might have of being called legalistic, or, well, you're just limiting growth, or you're just, you know, the Mark Dever where you can't even have multi-services, and you're just kind of stifling what God's trying to do. You're quenching the spirit might be something else that you will hear. But it is very likely that we turn people into spectators coming for the one-man show, and soon we see that we've not created a beautiful, pure, growing bride. We've created something entirely that's just a franchise of our own vision and desires. I've personally been given some really good reasons for multi-site now from the advocates of multi-site. Not the fair and nuanced list I just gave you, but these are real things that I've been told in some of the meetings that I've been in on all sorts of sides, theologically, if you will, pre-conversion and post. No one is anointed like the lead pastor. He's why people are here. Multi-site with his face on a screen is the only way we're going to draw people. No one's going to go if it's not him. Another one, when the momentum is working in the anointed leader's favor, don't plant churches or raise up other preachers. That kills the momentum because now you're diversifying your resources and your people and your leaders. Plant multi-sites with a video screen. People are here because the anointed. Exact quote in one of those meetings. Church planting is a waste of money and time. With multi-site, you have flexibility, you have speed, and you have a better stewardship of resources. Another one, it takes years to raise up others in a church to preach and teach. Amen is right. You could launch 3 to 4 multi-sites in that span of time, and the quality of the preaching product, I'm quoting, doesn't change. You can almost begin to sense the problem right away. It takes years to raise somebody up to preach and teach. But if I get on a screen, the product doesn't change. The quality stays where it is. We can do that. And all of a sudden, it's another form of building the Tower of Babel. Revitalization in churches is just filled with wars. It'll burn you out. Your growing church should just buy out a struggling church's property. Don't revitalize. Don't send someone in there to be used by the Lord to bring healing and establish something strong again. Turn it into a multi-site. Put your face on the screen and watch people start filling the seats again. Staffing a multi-site is easy. This is the 6th thing I've heard and been told. Stick a campus pastor in charge, who's more of a manager than a leader, so he doesn't really steal your thunder or try to take over. He'll honor your ministry and your position while still doing all of the work that you can't physically do. Number 7, if men in your church want to preach and plant churches, pay them so good they won't leave. Exact quote by a megachurch pastor in San Diego just about a year and a half ago in a room that I was in. If these arguments are made at a business seminar, we're rolling. Yes. Yes. Costi's cookies, whatever you want to call it, right? Let's launch a restaurant. Let's launch a brand. Let's launch our own, you know, Lululemon, whatever brand business, and sell athletic gear. Whatever. It's got to be this. It's got to be this. It's got to be this. And then, yeah, because we're selling a product to consumers. But when we're talking about the church, we're not talking about branding. We're not talking about being the forethinking CEO with, you know, I'm the reason, and I, and I, and I, and more I. And that's where we begin to see the problem. If that attitude and approach is not tempered, and at the very least talked through with caution and with prayer before we start to try to be innovative, we can quickly begin to infringe on making disciples biblically, modeling humility, and then multiplying real churches. Yeah, doing the work that takes 3 to 4 years to raise up another young man and then launching him out like an arrow to go and lead and multiply. Yeah, it takes 3 to 4 years, but if I can be so frank, and I will, Driscoll's burnt out and gone. People raised up for 3 to 4 years are going to put together, Lord willing, if he lets them live, and that's God's plan, 30 to 40 years of ministry, 30 to 40 times over from seminary classrooms in different states, in different countries around the world. So yeah, while one man may be faster on his own, when there are more involved, you will go much further and much longer than what we are scene. So I want to walk you through three potential slaughters of the multi-site model. I feel like I've been fair. I've said where we can maybe see it used in nuance. I've made clear the thinking of what I'm referring to. Now I want to give you the potential slaughters of the multi-site model. The first one is the slaughter of making disciples. The potential slaughter of making disciples. Jesus had very basic instructions to guide the church's role and purpose being left on earth. It's in Matthew 28, shocker, called the Great Commission. You go and you make disciples. You don't make converts. You don't force them to get saved. You make disciples. And then you are with them. You baptize them. You teach them all that Jesus commanded. And what do disciples do? Well, they make disciples, and they make disciples, and make disciples. Obviously, Jesus is in the business of, if you will, making disciples, and such an endeavor is going to involve much more than one man on a screen or a manager doing announcements and some small groups hanging out. But that even isn't the main barrier to discipleship. It's the absence of life on life in the culture of a multi-site. It's, hey, I'm going to feed you and lead you from here. I'm going to teach you how to self-feed. You go and do it. Which works great, again, in the business world. When I pay you a big salary, give you a job description, tell you to work or you're fired, and go figure it out. And if you don't pull it off, I'm just going to fly your position, and I'm going to get a headhunter to find me another one, and I'm going to, what, hire someone else to do it. It doesn't work that way in the church. You can't fire your sheep. They are given to you. You can discipline them. Some of them, if they're false converts or you get to step three, you can send them on down the road and kick them out of the church and then evangelize them. Yeah, but in the end, we are called to a life-on-life awareness. We're called to walk with difficult people, not separate ourselves from them. And if you have a large church, then you better have a large group of elders, so you better be largely, what, making disciples and raising up another generation of godly leaders. So we'll see a lot of life-on-life ministry in a biblical church. It means iron sharpening iron. You're not going to get a lot of that with screen time. If you elevate your man as the anointed leader, and there isn't a host of leaders surrounding him who are plural, who can speak into his life, and deacons as well, and men fulfilling their mandate to make disciples, you don't have what will be essential to a healthy church. You relegate the congregation to become consumers. And then, of course, I mentioned already 2 Timothy 2:2, where Paul tells Timothy, the things which you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust these truths to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Not every multi-site right now is going to be slaughtering discipleship. That's not what I'm saying in this. But over the long-term haul, you will see a big difference between a church that prioritizes life-on-life discipleship, raising up more church leaders to go and deploy, but also to stay and serve that congregation than anything else you'll ever see. We need pastors who are present. We need pastors and elders who are intentional. We need our leaders to stay busy raising up other leaders to join them in equal ministry, not feed our egotistical empire. Number two, the potential slaughter of humility in our leadership. It might be working. It might be growing. You might not be slaughtering discipleship. Maybe you've got some great training programs. You might even have a seminary there, and it's all going great. But if you take the multi-site approach like we've talked through, in predictable fashion, the CEO mindset of the single autocratic ruler over the empire will breed an arrogance the likes of which we don't see even in the world, because Satan especially loves when pastors get that way. He feeds it even more because, as you know, he's the god of this world. He's not highly as invested in making unbelievers act unbecoming. He's already blinded them. He loves to infiltrate our ranks in the church because there's way more damage than there could ever be.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
On this topic.
Yep.
In your analysis, when you have been in these, when you've been the silent observer role, and
the other meeting, I wasn't silent. Just to be fair. Just so you know. Sorry. Keep going.
Transparency.
Keep going.
That's the right humility, right?
Go.
Bye. this whole advocation of the anointed person, are the anointed ones advocating the anointing and the role of the anointed ones when they talk about these models? Because if they're the voices of the anointed, it basically the self-identification as anointed and their kind in that role, how can it not fly in the face of number two?
That's why this has to be on the list.
Yeah.
Number two's got to be on the list because you have two things. You have the self-advocating anointed, and then you have the stage-sharing endorsement of the anointed. And here's what in one of the meetings was very interesting, and then in the other meeting completely different. The meeting that I was in with Driscoll, he actually explained to us how it works, and he said, I have pastors, but I'm apostolic. I'm the apostle here. I really believe, like, I'm the apostle. I believe it that way. He said, I don't have a board of elders. I don't have any plurality. No one tells me what to do here. I've already been down that road, and I saw the way it went and what they did to me. So flat out. He said, I have a board of elders from Gateway Church, Robert Morris, and that group in Southlake, Texas. He said, they're my board. They set my salary. They protect me. If someone has an issue, they can go to them. But those guys are who Grace and I answer to. They are my apostolic elders. They're my apostles. I'm the apostle here. I go in, and he did this with his hands. I'll never forget it as long as I live. I had eaten Wendy's on the way. I remember the day like it was yesterday. I just ate my Wendy's, and I kept my mouth shut as long as I could. He said, I go into every layer of ministry that I want, and I can tell my pastors what to do on any level. They do not come up here and tell me what to do. I'm an apostle. They are under me. And that's what I've learned from everything that I went through, is I have an apostolic anointing. Then he flipped it. And he said, this one right here, pointed at a certain gentleman in the room, has the apostolic anointing. You ride his wave, you support him, you get behind him. So right there, same thing that I saw in the prosperity gospel in different forms of movement, the same thing you'd even see in circles of cult leaders and unbelievers. If I could get you to endorse me that way to my team, then when I go back to lead them on Monday, I don't got to say a word. You already told everyone I'm the anointed. And now we're even living in a twisted form of Proverbs when, remember Proverbs, let the lips of another praise you, not your own mouth. Mm. Perfect. So go ahead and tell everybody that I'm the apostle. They'll be scared to death to ever challenge me because they'll lose their paycheck. Then they got to go home and tell their wife, we need a GoFundMe page. I got to find a job. And it's over. And that breeds that thing. But in the other meeting, there was another gentleman who, the San Diego kind of church growth guy, was explaining about another gentleman, his anointing. And that, I begin to watch all this in these multiple meetings thinking, this is the way it was done where I came out of. So there's this slight adjustment in theological conservative approaches under the guise of sound doctrine, but the same, we'll call it a arrogant or maybe evil spirit. I don't know, the same little minion, little demonic assignment that the enemy gives his armies. Hey, it can look like prosperity gospel, great. But if they've got that figured out, let's try to get through the human ego. Because remember what James says? Where you have envy, where you have selfish ambition, you have every what? Every evil work. So we have to put this on the list because we have to deal with that. Thank you for, you guys can ask anything you want and interrupt me. That's what workshops are for. I've already gone through it, but some of the things that you might hear, whispers that you would be aware of. Would you mind? Thank you so much, Les. I was going to ask our not so local, but local European transfer. You'll hear whispers like, you know, you're the reason the church is like this. If you raise up leaders who are better than you, you know, you'll lose it all. We start to hold on to the rope. But a wise mentor once told me the guy who holds the rope the tightest is the one who gets burnt. We got to be real careful holding on to the church of Christ so tightly. How dare those small-minded elders try to control you? Imagine the disciples trying to tell Jesus what to do. Another one you might hear, it's not your fault you're so gifted. Why are they all mad? They're upset about multi-site. I didn't give myself these gifts, God did. Which is a beautiful way to set yourself up as the top of the pyramid. Don't those people understand the meaning of double honor and submission? You're in charge. You know, show them who the boss is. You know, you're the smartest guy in the room, and everybody knows it. So why wouldn't you be the one telling everybody what to do? Maybe it's time to put together an advisory board or a group of elders who know how special you are and will understand you the way you deserve to be understood. so these others don't hold you back from all that God wants for you. It reminds me so much of when Lucifer took Jesus on the temple. Hey, look at it all. Come on. You can have it. Here it is. Just do this. Pastoral ministry is about carrying a towel, not chasing a title. Leaders eat last. It's a mindset of the way up being down, God exalting the humble, not the haughty. So we are to be, like we read initially in 1 Peter, models of humility, a statue, if you will, something they look at and say, there's humility. Not, oh, there's the big anointed. We're to model humility. And that's going to even mean laying down our own rights. Do we have the right to do certain things? Of course. But I'm finding more and more, and I'm still younger and learning a ton on this side of ministry, that, you know, maturity is going to be me saying, not how far can I go and how far can I push and where's the line, but maturity is how far can I go to lay down my rights? How many things can I not fight for? And how many times can I lay down my life for? That's maturity, that service. What it also does is just slaughters the ego. It just kills pride. And the Lord loves that. He'll honor it. And I find that you probably lay on your deathbed a lot easier that way, too. And your kids may even be around you because they still like you. Multi-site ideology can easily become a springboard for disaster. So we want to be real careful that there's men around us who temper our ego. This is good for us. It is good for us to be outvoted sometimes. It is good for us to not have the consensus all for us. It is good for us, for older, wiser men, or men as old as us, to slap us around a little bit. Less is that for me. So is a man named Richard Bargas and a few others. Finally, the potential slaughter of multiplication. We want to multiply future leaders. Say what you want about Chuck Smith and Calvary Chapel. May not always agree with them over in California. Some people call them a bunch of hippies, Jesus movement, whatever. Bottom line is, it multiplied. You say what you want about JMAC, John MacArthur, Grace Church, different doctrinal positions that people have, but they multiply men and women like an army of warriors. And then look where you are right here. Hey, colonial, now shepherds. Not everyone's going to agree with you doctrinally. Not everyone's going to like everything methodologically. Not everyone's going to have their idea go forth and voted on and agreed to. And now it's, you know, this, that, and the other of preference. But duplication, where you have men committed to raising up others. The list goes on and on. What happens when leaders die or eventually they pass off ministry? Well, those churches continue to live on. They don't care if it's their brand. They don't care if it's their logo. They don't care if it's still them on a screen. They evangelize, they disciple, they train, they deploy. They evangelize, they disciple, they train, they deploy. Wash, rinse, repeat over and over. You die, you raised up others who do it, and they keep doing it, and you get to enjoy worshiping around the throne. Multiplication is everywhere in the New Testament, from Jesus and his disciples to Paul, Timothy, Titus, and the host of others. If you ever want to see a chapter on this, just go to 2 Timothy 4. And besides Alexander the coppersmith, who did Paul much harm, and Demas, who deserted him, you remember all the names of the people? And that doesn't even count the list at the end of Romans and the names that are added in. You have dozens of people who are partnered with Paul in ministry. Never a one-man show. Never about the man being the guy. And so we want to make sure that we take great care. I think I could end by saying multi-site is not sinful in that sense that you're using technology. Multi-site is not evil. It takes sin to succumb to your ego. It takes sin to self-appoint and self-anoint. Using a screen doesn't do that. You guys understand that. It's the human heart. It's the wickedness of the me monster in my show. Also, multi-site is not essential. You can honestly argue that unless you're in a very specific, nuanced context, multi-site's not even useful. Shepherd the flock. Give them your life. Raise up leaders. And if God puts you on the mission field and you've got to use some innovative things to figure out a way to get around the government, God bless you. Your name will never be mentioned in my workshop. But for the most part, biblical discipleship is essential. And we want to make every effort to preserve that mandate and do all we can to be faithful in that regard. Thanks, guys, for listening. to my arguments. Do you have any questions to finish, or do you need to go? Yes, sir.
Do you make a distinction between multi-site, in your arguments against multi-site, between multi-site and multi-services?
I do.
Not just like we're flowing, so we need a second service for a while, but as a sustainable model.
I do. I make a distinction. I'm at a church, even with our, I'll use our church plant because it's a better example than the church I'm currently at for what I would do. We're planting a church, and we're going to start with two services, and we've told our team already, serve one, attend one. We want, because we don't, I don't want them missing the gathering of the saints. Now they're back there, you know, doing some. I also want to have, we're a church plant, so I want to have Sunday school classes. I want to have other men teaching and doing various things. I want to have a marriage workshop, a parenting thing going on. And so it's not the Costi Hinn show, and it's not, well, just come and hear me and then go figure it out in your small groups. And so I look at that and think, we know them. Our eyes are on them. We're asking them to serve. It's a morning of the ecclesia coming together. So I would make that distinction. I'm not a Mark Deverite in that sense of one service is the assembly, otherwise you have two churches. I believe that you have physical elders present, and I'm in your life, and I'm with you, and we're fist bumping.
Kind of in the middle of Dever and the multi-site, where you find yourself.
Where I would find myself, yeah, I think multi-site's going to be where we describe, not necessarily even multi-campus, where you have like pastors and elders teaming up to go shepherd as many people as they can, and even an autonomy. I would say the multi-service is a completely different conversation. To where I think, though, every local group of elders needs to make their own decision together and pray. I'm in a church now, right now, full disclosure, because you'll look online and be like, Costi's at that church. What in the world is he talking about? Five services, two on Saturday, three on Sunday, and they're talking about a sixth and putting on a different night, or some other guru came and told us that you should do multi-site. So I'm planting in February. I'm going to go a little bit of a different direction with some things. But overall, you know, there's lots of middle ground and lots of nuanced gray area. I wouldn't even necessarily be referring to that. Every group of elders has to decide, you know, we were four services on Sundays. And then what starts to happen, though, naturally, because I've been in it now and I've seen it for the last 2 years, I don't know people. And not that I have to know everyone, like personally, I'm at your house every week type thing, but we have a constant flow of people on different days at different times in different places. And literally our entire leadership team and staff have no clue who hundreds of people are.
And that's what I was wondering, where does that multi-service begin to break down?
Yep.
Like a multi-service.
I think you got to be in the room together as elders. You got to be on your knees praying, and you got to have the honest discussion and go, guys, do we know everyone? How's member care? Pastor who's in charge of, you know, member roster and updating it and dishing it out to everyone we pray. And you got to be honest with each other and go, yeah, I literally don't know who 400 of these names are. Have no clue. Well, how long they've been coming? Well, based on their record of attendance, they've been here the last several weeks or several months. And you're going, okay, is this problematic? Should we kind of divide and conquer here? Should we have another church plant in town? 400 people are coming from 15.
So all three of those things matter in that context.
That's
all.
Right. You,
it's for the church,
yep.
Right? It always matters.
And you've got to, and
by future leaders.
And I got to lay myself down in that moment if I'm the lead guy, and I'm pumped, like, but this is, I mean, we got a church of 2,000 people. We don't want to, and go, you know what? What's your name?
Jeremy.
I got to go, you know, I can still get lunch with Jeremy. I can love Jim. We can do an annual conference with all our churches, but we may need to just, Jeremy, there's the 400 of them are coming from over there. Let's stick you there. And will you two men pray about going? Because you live there anyway. And let's just, and I think that's why you got to have those conversations so that when it gets to that point of no longer, it's like serve one, attend one, and we're all here and helping each other as one body. Now you're into 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 services, and it's like, yeah, revival, but no one knows anyone. But we look good on the outside. Big conversations have to happen at the elder level.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you could address it more from the perspective of somebody in the pew. Like I have family in Oklahoma, and there's a big network of multi-site churches in Oklahoma, Life Church. My in-laws have been kind of spotty at church their whole lives. And my father-in-law is former Roman Catholic, very young believers, very spiritually mature believers, and my mother-in-law has struggled with him their whole marriage to get him to go to church. And now he loves listening to Life Church, Craig Rochelle. He loves going to Life Church in Tulsa and watching Craig Rochelle on the screen.
Yep.
So and my wife has tried to talk to him, say that's not the best way to do church. You need accountability, you need actual pastors and elders and all this type of stuff. But this is the one he wants to, this is the only one that he's been excited about going to in the last 20 years. Like, how would you address that more from, like, we've talked about it from a leadership standpoint.
Totally.
But from somebody in the pew.
Yep. Well, one more element to repeat of the leadership element of it all. This is why we got to have the conversation with a whole new generation about ecclesiology in that sense, at least talking through, where the lines are, where should we be thinking about it as a congregant and a future church member? Because then guys like him don't necessarily end up sucked into the Grishel approach. However, since he's there already, I would give him a book, maybe from a guy like, Nine Marks of a Healthy Church by Dever, that kind of book, a book about ecclesiology. There's another one called The Master's Plan for the Church by MacArthur. Moody published that. Looking at biblical ecclesiology and talking through it, the question is this: does he care about that? Most people, if they're not really thinking through it, or they're not a church leader, or they're not serving, or they're not involved, they have no need to know. Like, they're like, I don't need to know. Who cares? Whatever. I just like Craig. What's the big deal? So he may not be there. Would you say he's definitely converted? Like, you would look and be like, this guy's saved. He's on fire for God. Like, he's just all about it. Or he's enjoying a cultural Christian approach.
I would say he's nominally Christian, potentially saved.
I would get coffee with a guy like that, and I would talk. I wouldn't even go to his, version of church. I would go, hey, man, how you doing? How's your holiness? How's your lust? How's your use of your phone? How any challenges with pornography or anything like that?
Yeah.
I would just get in there with him on sin.
Well.
And then if he starts opening up, you go, you need this, huh? Want to get together every week? And I would just start relationship with him. When you start doing that, you go, do you have anyone at the church, that can help you or anything like that? Yeah, I mean, this is why we need each other, right? So let's do it. And you start showing him what church looks like, quote, church, people. But that would be one of the few ways. I find that those are the most challenging people to reach because they're good. They got Craig.
Yeah.
They watch online. And what it does is it pushes away life-on-life accountability and biblical ecclesiology. So I'd try to go there with them and press in, and then nicely but lovingly at some point tell them this is wrong. This is the wrong way to do the Christian life. You're a lone ranger. There's no such thing as an online pastor. You need real church, real people who know you. Even if they're not as dynamic as Craig, they'll love you 50,000 times better than him. So let's go. So I would do that, if that helps. Good luck, man. Be praying for you. Yes, sir?
I don't mean to hold you hostage, but I actually grew up in Seattle. A lot of my family went to Mars Hill before it fell apart. And so one time I wanted to go, and I went to one of their campus churches.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting because it was just in a middle school that was only 20 minutes away from his main church. So,
yep.
It was weird that people weren't willing to just drive 20 minutes, go to the real thing. And it was basically we just sat in the auditorium on metal chairs. Some guy came up, opened the projector. People came in 20, 30 minutes late with McDonald's in their pajamas. And So when I was there, I was like, I wonder, is it just it's a problem from the leadership perspective, but is it also a laziness from the people in a sense that, this is more convenient, nobody's going to grill me for coming late, or
totally,
no one's going to keep me accountable, and instead of driving 20 minutes, I'll walk across the street to the middle school and just sit, for an hour and watch TV.
Absolutely. I think that played out so clearly during COVID. When everyone was sort of doing online and different people doing this. I remember watching one promo where a guy, same San Diego crew, said, yeah, man, watch church, throw a watch party, have a hangout, do a barbecue, grab your mimosas, whatever. And it was this like casual approach. And then somebody else was like, yeah, for communion, like grab whatever. Hey, grab the mimosa. I don't care. You know, and it's this casual approach to church life. Stay in your jammies, eat your pancakes, watch church, and then go on with your day. And I'll tell you what, it is one of the easiest things to do. A few weeks ago, we're on vacation. I don't like take a vacation from church. I'm trying to model for my family that, like, just because daddy works, quote, labor vocationally at the church. When we're on vacation, I'm like, I've always loathed. I did that in the prosperity gospel days. I used to be like, we are the church. We just flew around the world to serve. I don't need to go anywhere on Sunday. That worked out real well. And we're away, and we were driving and trying to get somewhere. There was a huge issue with the hotel, and my whole family with me. We miss, like, we're not even able to drive to where we needed to go. And I'm like, oh. And then all we could do was go grab food. I was so frustrated. And finally, I'm like, all right, honey, it's okay. And then I made a joke. I was like, what do we do? I'm like, I'm a qualified elder. I guess I'll lead church in our home. It's house church night tonight with the kids. I was so bothered that I didn't get to go. We're obviously not forsaking the assembly as a habit at that point. It was a huge mishap with our travel. And we go to eat because there's nothing to do. We go eat and go to bed. We go eat and I go to bed and I look over at my wife and I said, let's pretend the day didn't go like it did and we're not frustrated. How easy was this? We're sitting at a park, eating food, chilling. My kids are happy. They're running around. They're not screaming. There's no nursery worker being like, sorry, here's your baby back. There's no guy yelling at me about my sin. There's no one to deal with. No one's this close to me. Like, hey, pastor, how are you? I'm like, hey, how are you? I don't know who you are. Like, good to meet you. And No. I started kind of making caricatures of all the like things that you could experience on a Sunday. And she was like, I know, dangerous, isn't it? I was like, yep. Now imagine online world, stay in your jammies. You make bacon and me that omelet that you make and we chill at home. And then I'm going to Home Depot. I'm going to the river. I'm going whatever. Who cares? And nobody can deal with my sin. I'm not accountable, but I did church. Check the box. I'm good. I think the consumeristic mindset paired with the leaders who play it up is your combo. It just like false teachers, though, and I'm not saying that everyone's going to hell who does that online thing. I'm just saying they raise them up in accordance with their own desires because they want their ears tickled. So they deserve each other in a way. They create one another. It's an ecosystem. Same thing with this stuff.
We're selling indulgences again.
Totally.
That's it.
Do your thing.
Yep.
Grab your mimosa. Let's have communion. No thanks.
In my church world, the congregation has been much, much slower in coming back. And so what I'm hearing is what I see a lot now. They are enjoying the online services.
Yep.
So how do we, we're promoting small groups, but I don't think we're not doing a lot there either. Maybe a third of the church is doing small groups. Mm-hmm. So that's my challenge. How do we, what kind of stipulations, or can you put in a stipulation on this church, what real church membership is about?
Yeah, I think you meet with the elders together, you pray, and you establish it locally. What's the messaging going to be? I personally would be a fan of, at this stage of things, saying if you are not an individual who is, I'd try to be fair to the arguments that are out there right now and say, if you're not an individual that is sick and you're home and you're vulnerable and you're having very major challenges and you've got to shut in and lock down right now, you need to be here. We're coming back. We're back. And we're allowed to be back and we're going to be back. It's time to come back and get in each other's life. And I would try to make the case for it biblically. I wouldn't appeal to life. We need you back here. And I would just say, we need each other. We need to be in each other's lives. We need accountability. We need to be faithful. Enough is enough. We had our little era of this and now that's over. It's time to come back. So we're saying as your elders and your church leaders that it's comeback time. We're here, we're in person, and we're you could say requiring, or we are saying biblically to all our members, those of you who believe Hebrews 13:17, that you submit to us, we're going to give an account to the Lord. And right now we feel conviction that it is time to call the flock back in person because we're going to face Jesus one day And right now, we've reached the point where we believe it's time for us to call you back. So it's time to come back. Something like that. But I'd ensure that that whole group of leaders is agreed. Because once you go there, you're going to have pushback from people who think it's a bit strong or they don't agree. But I think you'll have a bunch of people come back too. So the last element would be to pray through. We had about 200 people stop coming to our church because we broke for like a few months in Arizona, and then we're like, all right, let's get back. And we had this whole fringe group that were just coming and going. They were just doing church to check it out. They're not back, probably because most of them were falsely converted or not. They weren't converted. So I'm not saying that's all your people, but
there's a group in there. Believers to start.
I'm sure there's a group in there that feels zero compulsion to come back because they weren't actually saved or they were just checking out things. Right. So I hope that's helpful. I try to have those conversations and maybe
I saw one church that they did that with the elders, but they elders went to each family themselves. Like they took a portion and it wasn't a message that got broadcast by email or whatever.
It was a personal visit.
It was a personal visit from an elder that says, this is what we're deciding to do. What is it? What is your issue? What is going on? Why are you like this?
So
and so it roots out all the excuses because you know them, and you know you can get into their personal lives. Well, no, I know that you guys aren't dealing with this.
That's so good.
That's great.
Yeah, visiting, maybe making a list of all the small groups and all the families, mm-hmm. and even trying to visit if you've got a small group where they're meeting. There's like four or five families there. Have a couple elders go visit the small groups even. Who are meeting and extend that. You may have more consensus even faster as they're like, the elders came to visit our, that was awesome. Mm-hmm. Let's go back, guys. That kind of thing.
Right.
Make it a good thing. Good wisdom there, man. All right. Well,
this was a good session, my brother.
I'm grateful for the time with you guys. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Costas.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this session from the 2021 Shepherds 360 International Church Leaders Conference. This material is copyrighted and may not be altered or sold. For information, visit shepherds360.org.